I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
73 seconds after launch, something unthinkable happened to the Space Shuttle Challenger.
Obviously a major malfunction.
We could not believe what we were seeing. The Challenger Legacy.
Join us as we uncover what really happened.
Listen now by searching Science Friction on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
In a hospital bed in the early hours of the morning, still wearing the clothes that he was beaten in, Gregor Palasik tells police what happened during the robbery and how he knew his wife Irma was dead. That interview, recorded on a camcorder in 1999, has been played to the court. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Just a warning, there's some descriptions of violence in this episode. This is episode 2 of the case of the two intruders.
Irma Palasik's brutal murder rocked her family and has haunted them for 24 long years.
This wasn't the average robbery.
The brutality of the attack shocked the community.
They were virtually tortured that night.
Violently assaulted before the two men ransacked the premises and stole cash and jewellery.
My grandparents were beaten and my grandmother was left to die on the lounge room floor.
This week has given us a real insight into who the Palasiks were and what the hours after the fatal 1999 robbery looked like. Elizabeth Byrne, ACT court reporter, welcome back to The Case Of.
Thanks, Stocky.
And as well as Elizabeth, we are also very lucky to have ACT investigative reporter James Viver joining us for the pod as well. James, welcome.
Thank you.
Really looking forward to unpacking everything that's happened over the last week or so with both of you. Liz, to get us going, can you wrap up the evidence from this week in 60 seconds or so for us?
This week we've been getting down into the details. We've had the recollections from the neighbours, police, family members about the three times that the Palasiks were targeted by burglars. The family members have given an account of how the first robbery in 1997 saw more than $100,000 taken from under the house where it had been hidden. And neighbours told how in 1998 they heard Irma Palasik screaming and went to help when she'd been attacked by a man in a balaclava and she'd been punched and was on the ground. She had to run for help from there. By 1999, the couple had moved across town to be safer, with tragic consequences, as we know. This week, the court heard Gregor Palasik's 000 call and the only first-hand account of the murder in a long interview with police from his hospital bed.
Thank you, Liz. There's been so much that we've heard over the last week and really looking forward to unpacking all of that in this episode. I think where I'd like to start, though, is the interview that Gregor Palasik gave with police following the robbery. This is 1:30 in the morning. Gregor Palasik has found his wife dead after this home invasion. He's being interviewed by police from his hospital bed. Liz, how was he?
It was quite interesting. He was lying basically flat on the bed. We couldn't really see much of his face. He was still in his clothes. And he seemed to be, he was anxious to tell the police what had happened. At times he was a little bit emotional, but he seemed to be quite lucid at times as well, explaining what had happened. And of course, they asked their police questions, which go over and over the same thing sometimes. Some of the things he said to them, they were quite surprised by, particularly the amount of money that was in the house. He seemed to be quite lucid, but also, obviously, he'd been in a bit of stress over what had happened.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking about how he's still wearing, you know, his clothes. I'm not in a hospital gown or anything like that. What kind of state is he in? Has he still got, you know, bindings around his wrists and ankles? Has that been tidied up?
some of those things were still there. They hadn't sort of, they have to collect them. The forensic scientists have to collect them.
Yeah.
So he still had some of those things. The other thing, of course, is we know that he was injured from his own beating. One of the things that happened was his tongue had a laceration. So his speech was a little bit difficult to understand at times. But as I said, he did seem to be quite anxious to tell the police how things had unfolded.
And Liz, I mean, we're getting this video from Gregor in the hospital bed recorded by the police after the robbery. And I suppose this is the only way we'll hear evidence directly from Gregor. Right, Liz?
That's right, because, of course, he died in 2004 from unrelated causes, and this was the only way the police could present this first-hand account to the jury.
Yeah, what were the police asking him about?
They were asking how the men got into the house. Did he know them? Did he recognise them? Which, of course, he said he didn't. They asked about could he see what was happening with his wife? And, of course, we now know he couldn't see what was going on because she was in the corridor, but he could hear her screaming. He said it was dreadful screams. And this went on for some time. Before she stopped and then before he was able to free himself after the men left.
Yeah, I mean, this is such graphic descriptions, hearing how, you know, Gregor has recounted this interaction to the police, you know, hearing how, you know, he could hear Irma screaming for, you know, that period of time and then not screaming. This was all played to the court. It was a video recording from the interview in the hospital bed. James, what's it like in the room hearing all of this?
We sit at the back, Stocky, in the public gallery, and if you imagine a large, almost exactly square room, it's got very high ceilings, it's quite a modern building, the SD courts are fairly modern. We sit at the back, and so to set the scene for people, over to the left from where we sit are the defendants, and they usually sit with some prison officers, corrections officers. Obviously, the judge is in front, and he presides over everything. It's sort of about 50% higher than everybody else. In the middle, you have the bar table, and then over to the right, you have the jury and the jurors, and that's where they sit along there. Where we sit at the back, you can sort of see everybody and everything. We're directly opposite the judge.
Yep.
And in showing this evidence, how it was shown in court is on a large plasma TV screen, sort of directly in front of us and slightly off to the right. There's also a large screen which faces the defendants as well. And so this video was played out to the court in that way. And as Liz said, you know, he's lying flat in this hospital bed. It's in the hours immediately after this incident has happened in 1999. You know, he's got this white hospital blanket over him. There's a box of tissues that sort of lies on his shins. He's connected up to some hospital equipment. There are two police officers in the room. They're standing either side of him. They're wearing suits. There's a black cable, which you can see traces up over the white bed sheets, which is the microphone. And he talks with his hands a lot, gesticulates. You can't quite see his face in this evidence for most of it. But as Liz said, you can hear that his speech is, I suppose, restricted because of the injuries that he is in hospital for as a result of this this incident in 1999. So there were really highly emotional moments in this evidence. I think it's fair to say, you know, the jury sat and watched it all in one chunk. I mean, there was a moment where they asked if Gregor needed a break. And this is when he was talking about when he found Irma and he was establishing whether she was still alive. You know, he tried to rouse her. He said, come on, come on, get up, get up. And of course, she was not able to. By that time, she had passed. So we're taken to the exact pinpoint moment that Gregor discovered that his wife was no longer alive. And that evidence really hung in the courtroom and for the jury. The police officers asked if he needed a break. He said no. He kept going on. Eventually, they did break about halfway through. They needed to change the tape in the camcorder, which clearly dates it in 1999, and they got a nurse to come in and check on him, and then they proceeded with quite perfunctory questions around who knew about certain elements of the break-in and so forth, and tried to sort of do that investigative piece as well. So
yeah,
it was pretty confronting evidence.
Yeah, yeah. As well as this video, we've learned a lot about the Plasics family, you know, who Irma and Gregor were. In that police interview, Gregor talks about emigrating from Hungary in the 50s. He talks about being from near the Austrian border, I think. So I had a map up to have a look at Hungary through that stage. Liz, what was their life like in Australia?
Well, they seem to have had a fairly good life here. They had a business in Fishwick in Canberra, a joinery business, and they had two daughters who had grown up and had grown up children of their own by the time of these events. They seemed to be a fairly close family. Gregor talked about, you know, being taken shopping by his daughters, and so it seemed to be a fairly close-knit family. They socialised at the local Hungarian club when they lived in Red Hill and had a lot of community connections. They liked to play the pokies, but not overly. And they also had a home where they liked to keep things that they'd bought. It was quite interesting, wasn't it, James, when they discussed in court what was at the home at the time of actually the first burglary when the $100,000 was taken.
Yeah, it was. We had these little brushstrokes, glimpses into the personality of Gregor and of Irma Sr. We heard, and just to consolidate it all down, but to give people the source and to let people know that this is what the jury heard, we heard recorded police interviews from Elizabeth, which is one of the Palasik's daughters. She was then, by that point, Elizabeth Makita, and Irma Jr., for the purposes of the conversation, Irma Jambor, who was another daughter, and sort of bringing some of what they told police and therefore subsequently now the court about their mother and father, that yes, they like to go on a Sunday and play the pokies. There was often a raffle at the club that they would go and join in on. You know, they'd get rounds of drinks in for friends. Under the house, the first house that they lived in for the purposes of this case in Red Hill, it was quite a big sort of cellar complex where they had, well, near enough everything, including hundreds of thousands of dollars, as we later found out, stashed in biscuit tins and locked boxes under carpet and so on. They liked to stockpile things when they were the right price. They'd buy in bulk things like dog biscuits, or as it was described in court, grog, as well as appliances and cardboard boxes and the general sort of collectings, I suppose, of people who were of that generation. Other little brushstrokes, things like there were walnuts always hanging under the house because it was kind of one of their favourite snacks. And we heard later on also that Irma liked to have lemon in her tea, and she would go out to her lemon tree and collect lemons to put in her tea. And, you know, that Gregor would fall asleep on a Sunday afternoon in front of the TV having been to the club. So quite touching details from those closest to the Palasics about their life in Canberra before all of this happened.
Yeah, oh, that's a beautiful picture that we've been able to kind of get of the Palasics through the evidence of their daughters and other people before the court. And their life, I guess, in the last few years, you know, prior to this 1999 robbery, is so intertwined with these robberies, unfortunately. You know, we have 1997, where $100,000 is taken, 1998, when Irma is assaulted, and ultimately 1999, where Irma is killed. And now the prosecution isn't saying that Steve Fabrizi and Joseph Vacconi were involved in all of those robberies. They're only using select couple to link them to the Palasics. But Liz, talking about the 1997 robbery, you mentioned the Hungarian club before. Was that where Gregor and Irma were when that robbery took place?
Yes, they were out that night, thankfully, and they didn't notice the robbery until they came home. Elizabeth said it was a taped police interview that we heard. She told the police that at first when she went to her mother to help, she laughed because she couldn't believe that they had stashed so much cash under the house. And it had been very well hidden, but the people seemed to have still found it anyway and made off with it. And the family then became quite concerned about the way that money was being stored in the house. And there was a little bit of family concern about that.
Is that something that, you know, the court has heard Irma was kind of known to do?
Yes, it is. Over time, it emerged that she did keep quite a bit of cash around the house. Now, In 1998, nothing was taken. That was simply she surprised them. She actually went out to get a lemon for her tea, and she surprised them, and that's how she came to be assaulted.
Yep.
In 1999, in the lead up to that, they had been, or Irma had been collecting cash and putting it in a secret drawer in the kitchen, hidden under the wall oven.
Right.
Now, that caused the family a bit of concern, but Elizabeth's husband had sort of arranged for that to be put in because they felt that if they didn't give them something, then they might just stash it around the house like they had in the past. So it was a concern for the family.
Yes, yeah. And because there's the three robberies that, you know, the Polesics are a victim to over this period, 97, 98 and 1999. And it's after the 1998 robbery that they decide they want to move house, basically. And they look at going to another suburb. Where do they end up buying, Liz?
They ended up buying a house in a suburb called McKellar, which is a very long way from Red Hill, where they had been living. And they bought the house off another Hungarian couple who said, it's all well set up, it's great. They bought it, moved in, and Elizabeth said in her police interview, the very first thing that happened was the ceiling in the kitchen fell down. And it was because the tiles were broken above it. And then Elizabeth told the court they had to get lots of tradespeople to fix the repairs because there were things like the tiles were broken, the plastering needed to be done, and then her husband arranged for a new kitchen and their grandson did most of the work on it. But she was asked about who had done this work, and Adam fixed the tiles. She couldn't remember his last name. Bluey, otherwise known as Wayne, fixed the plastering. And George did the painting, and there were a number of others as well. There was a plumber, but it was a bit of an Australian story, I thought.
Yeah. James, looking through the tradespeople that were called in to assist, looks like there was a real cast of characters that were enlisted by the Polesics to help renovate their home in McKellar.
You got the sense that they were the trades that they had used perhaps as part of their business, which had then been handed down to their family. And the police were quite thorough with this, everything from, you know, carpet to curtains to tiles to paint to the lot, really. And you got the sense that, you know, the jury was being played this to give the thoroughness of what the police were trying to establish in terms of who might have known about Irma and Gregor. But really what we've been hearing in evidence is mostly Irma and her habit and their habit of keeping quite large amounts of cash. We heard in that same sort of tranche of evidence, Elizabeth talking about going and cashing checks for her mother, you know, to the tune of thousands of dollars at a time. And, you know, she subsequently learned after the 1997 incident that it was being stashed in every nook and cranny, as she put it, around the house, under the floorboards, in plastic bags, in boxes, and so on, as we've described. And so it was interesting to hear how the police were trying to establish or perhaps even rule out possibilities of who might have known about these cash stashing habits, to use Elizabeth's words, and therefore to sort of complete the investigative task.
Yeah, and you know, I can see the kind of the tension in the family that you would kind of end up with from that.
Definitely.
Right? You know, the concern that, you know, your parents were keeping this much money in the house, especially after being burgled previously as well. And yeah, I guess I'm trying to think of the word for this, but the compromise from Elizabeth and her husband John to build this, you know, this secret compartment underneath the oven. Did we hear much about how that was created, how that secret compartment worked?
One person who gave evidence said something about Dad had to screw it down to get things in and out of it, so it was quite well hidden. I think in the interview that Gregor gave police, he said it was one of the first things he noticed, because when he freed himself, he went to the kitchen to find something to cut the tapes off. And that was the first thing he noticed, that was empty. It was open and it was empty.
Yeah.
So it wasn't easy to get to, it wasn't easy to find, not easy to get to, and not easy to open.
Yeah, and, you know, going to the 1999 robbery, you know, Gregor Palacios has been, you know, tied up on the ground. He's been beaten. He's found his way to the kitchen after that, as you've just described, Liz, and noticed that this compartment has been removed. You know, we were talking before about how Irma screamed for a period of time and then stopped. Is this the moment where he then starts to look for his wife and go down the hallway?
That's right. He had to sort of undo himself a bit before so he could walk around. And then he went down the corridor towards where he thought Irma was, and that's when he found her. And she was lying on her front, so he turned her over and started to remove the tape from her mouth and said to her, you know, come on, come on, get up, get up. And she didn't respond, and he realised that she'd died.
Oh, God. I was reading the transcript of the police interview, and he talks about how he tried to call his daughter Elizabeth, talking about how he wanted her to come over. You know, he just sounds so scared. How was he in the interview?
There was a bit of a few emotional moments. That moment, though, did resonate with me as well. And then he can't remember if he rang Elizabeth's number and she didn't answer. Mm. And whether he did that first or he rang 000, because the police asked him, what did you do? What order did you do it in? But the thing that really resonated with me is once he'd rung 000, he said, I just sit down. What can I do? I can do nothing. And I thought that was perhaps the saddest moment for me.
Mm, yeah. Do we know at all how Irma died?
We haven't heard any evidence about the autopsy, really, other than that she died face down on the floor and that she'd had tape over her face. So no doubt that's to come. We're only just beginning that part of the evidence.
Yeah, we need to be very careful with what we talk about in the podcast because, you know, we can't present anything that hasn't been before the jury at this stage. I mean, you know, the way that Gregor has described this home invasion seems like such a violent interaction. I mean, you know, they had neighbours on either side of their house. There would be neighbours in the neighbourhood near this property. Did they hear anything through this at all, Liz?
Well, I found this very interesting, and we don't know if any of the things they heard or saw are even related. But it gives you a picture of what was going on around in the street at the time. So there were some neighbours in a share house with a man and two ladies, and they were watching Silence of the Lambs, which must have been on free-to-air TV that night. Mm. And all of a sudden, there was an almighty bang on what they thought was their roof. Oh. At the same time, another lady in the street, quite near the Palacios house, was also watching Silence of the Lambs in bed. She lived alone. And she heard the same noise and went out to investigate. And when she looked out the window at some point, she saw a man crouching in her garden. Mm. And then she saw all the police come, you know, they were around about that time. So that was probably a little bit after things had happened. But this was what was going on in the neighbourhood. There was another man who was out for a walk a little bit before that. And he said he'd seen two men he didn't know standing on a street corner nearby lighting cigarettes. So there's all this. This is the type of thing that police gather in a case like this, and it gives you a picture of what's been going on, whether any of this comes to be important in the case, we don't know, but at least we have some kind of view of what was going on.
And Liz, the Palacios have moved in between the 98 and the 99 robbery, and I guess a question that maybe in the mind of the jurors is, how did the people that broke into this house know where their new address was if, as the prosecution says, there's a thread between the 98 and the 99 robbery?
This is the mystery in this case. No one's presented any explanation to the jury about that yet. And I guess we'll just have to wait and see where this goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we spoke about in our first episode, something that will be key to this case is the DNA evidence that the prosecution will be presenting throughout. A key plank of that is swabs from items in the fridge of the Palacios home. How did the police know that they should be checking or swabbing items in the Palacios fridge, Liz, after such a kind of violent home invasion?
Well, this came down to Gregor, who there was a like a social worker, a victim support person, who actually came to the house and went to the hospital with him and stayed with him for some time. And during the course of events, after the police had finished talking to him, he said to her that he had glimpsed one of these men taking a swig from something in the fridge. And she, of course, working for the police, knew she must immediately tell, she knew that the forensics officers were still there. So she told them, and that's when they swabbed things in the fridge.
Right. Okay. And James, I mean, there's quite a bit of DNA evidence that has been discussed in the openings that's been talked about so far through this trial. I mean, my head's been kind of spinning as I've been trying to like keep markers on all of it. Now, how have you kind of kept your head around it? Have you made sense of all of that?
Yeah, it is, Stocky, it is a bit of one of those red string on the sort of the pinboard type moments. But for the purposes of the DNA side of things, which really will be a pivotal point of the case, I mean, you could tell that from the openings from both sides, the way they described it and so on. Really, 1997, we can take out of the equation when it comes to DNA. That doesn't really factor. Whilst it's part of the evidence that we're hearing, there's not DNA evidence. So we can sort of take that first robbery out of the scenario. The second robbery, when Irma came out to get her lemon in 1998 and interrupted what we suspect was going to be another robbery, and she was assaulted and so on. During that assault, she pulled the balaclava off of the offender. That obviously was put into evidence, collected by police, and something called tape lifts were made. So that essentially gathers the DNA evidence hairs from that balaclava. And then in 1999, of course, there was a lot of DNA evidence in the swabs taken from the fridge. As we heard, Gregor remembered that after the fact and told the sort of the victim support officer who was in court and giving evidence earlier in the week. And so what police then did is, yes, they took those DNA samples. One was from a water jug in the fridge. Mm-hmm. One was from a milk container.
Right.
Now, the easiest way to remember is to connect the two main strands, if you like, of DNA to the water jug and to the milk container. Now, the prosecution is alleging that the water jug has Vacconi's DNA on it and that the milk container has Fabrizi's DNA on it. Exactly how we've got there is still unfolding in court. What we do know is that from 1999, it took until 2014 before the technology could catch up in such a way that the DNA could start to be matched up from the balaclava to the water jug and in turn from Fabrizi to other unconfirmed matches, is how it was described in the opening. We haven't quite got to exactly extrapolate how a lot of these connections were made, other than that that Mr. Hickey, the prosecutor, has said, and I think we mentioned this in the last episode too on this case, is that it was 100 billion times more likely to be from both of the offenders, Vacconi and Fabrizi, than to be from someone else. And so if we just think, to summarize for people following along, you know, water jug, Vacconi, milk container, Fabrizi, everything else kind of flows from that and linkages. That's how we get our red string and connect everything together.
And James, I mean, you're talking about the bottles and the jug in the fridge. How does the balaclava fit in?
So the prosecution is alleging that the DNA sample collected from the balaclava in the robbery in 1998, the one that Irma pulled off of the offender at that incident when she was out getting the lemon for her tea, that DNA sample matches the DNA sample lifted from the 1999 incident from the water jug. And the prosecution alleged that those DNA samples not only match but belong to Vacconi. And on the other side of things, the prosecution is alleging that Fabrizi, who is only alleged to have been at the 1999 incident, that his DNA was on the milk bottle in the fridge.
Great. I appreciate the work you're doing with the sewing supplies, James, to keep us all across and on track with the DNA that's being presented here. There is still so much more to come in this trial. You know, we've still yet to hear the kind of the DNA evidence presented to the court and all those likelihoods and all of the other things that were likely tested as part of this investigation as well. And that is something that always takes a number of days to unfold. So it'd be interesting to see how that's presented and what we see from that. And then also how the defence is challenging that as well. Hearing in the openings, that is something that they will be likely challenging and, you know, asking the jury to think very critically about as we continue through this as well. Liz, no court sitting yesterday. Jury was given a break and a rest. What happened there?
Mr. Facchione was unwell yesterday, so the jury was given a little leave pass for the day. We'll go back to court today and see how we go. Yeah. But this happens from time to time.
Yeah, absolutely. We are getting all of the emails that are being sent to the case of at abc.net.au. We do really love hearing from you, and I'm excited to be able to put some questions to you, Liz and James, and actually a very timely one, considering the delay in the proceedings yesterday, because Beck has emailed and has mentioned that we, you know, often speak about backup jurors in case someone gets sick. But what happens in a long trial if a judge gets sick or has a family emergency? Does another judge sub in? Does the trial get postponed, or does it have to start over?
Well, I've never seen a judge sort of subbed in the middle of a trial. I did start to cover one trial where the judge died on the first day that they were able to just delay it a week and get another judge. But usually what happens is if a judge is sick, it might be a day, it might be 3 days, it might be 2 weeks. Mm. They often will just hit pause until the judge can come back. I've seen that a few times. Okay. And it also applies to other important people in the courtroom, like the prosecutor. I've seen a trial delayed for 10 days just recently because a prosecutor was very unwell. So that does happen. They do their best to keep it going because it costs so much in court time and money to run a trial.
Yes. And back on the jurors, if one of them gets sick and or for some other reason has to be excluded, when they impanel the jury, they essentially impanel extras. So I think you need 12. Isn't it, Liz?
Yes, 12. Yeah.
And for a trial that is set to go potentially between 3 and 6 weeks, they impanel 15. So you've got a few spares.
Yep. Oh, great. Thank you, James and Liz, for answering that question. Thank you, Beck, for sending it in to the case of at abc.net.au. We have another question here from Mike. He's written in and asked, how did the thieves know that the Palasics had so much cash and why did they have so much cash in their home?
Well, nobody knows how they knew. This is part of the thing that the court's trying to uncover, or the trial's trying to uncover. And I think the answer to why Irma Palasics had so much cash is she liked to deal in cash. So if she had a tradesperson in, she liked to pay them in cash. Her daughter said to the court, because as we know, the cash was hidden in a drawer, she said she thought it very unlikely, though, that anyone would have seen where that drawer was, that her mother would not have taken anyone near that hidey hole where she kept the cash, you know, when she was paying them. But it was the case that Irma liked to pay in cash.
Right. Okay. Good to know. Liz, thank you so much for answering that one. And Mike, wonderful question to send in, and I'm sure a question that has been on a lot of people's minds. If you have any questions yourselves, please get in touch. The case of at abc.net.au. As I've said, we really do love hearing from you. Your insights, your questions are so very welcome. Appreciate all your questions as well about the case of the Wheelie Bin murder. Don't worry, we are not abandoning that. I'm getting all of the messages about, you know, wondering where that is. We're going to have an update with you, with Eva, very, very soon. So don't stress. Make sure you grab ABC Listen because it's the best place to listen to the case of. And when we have an update from that and a new episode, we'll be dropping it in the feed. And we'll be back as well with Liz and James very soon for another episode of the case of the two intruders. Liz, where are we going next? Do we know how this trial might unfold?
Well, we had just begun the forensic evidence. There's been just a few questions put to the man who was running the forensic operation We haven't learned much from that yet, so I imagine we're about to get into all of that, and that will lead us to the DNA evidence.
One tiny thing that we did learn, Stocky, is that apparently the jury should imagine that it is like it is on TV. people might remember from the last episode that one of the defence lawyers talked about the evidence that the jury will hear, and it's not like CSI. It was interesting earlier in the week that we heard Clifford Frost talk about him describing what kind of PPE essentially they wore on the crime scene. And he said, just imagine what you see on TV. So obviously not knowing what had been said in the openings, it was an interesting juxtaposition.
Yes. On one side, it's not CSI. On the other side, it's CSI. So
exactly.
We'll see how this unfolds from here. Elizabeth, James, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of The Case of the Two Intruders.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The Case of the Two Intruders is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Elizabeth Byrne and James Viver and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. Thank you to senior lawyer Jasmine Sims, our legal queen, for her legal advice, to the ACT newsroom and to Audio Studios manager Eric George. This episode was produced on the land of the Ngunnawal, Ngambri, Turrbal and Wurundjeri people.